Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We begin our second hour by gathering the Dakota political junkies. Today, we're going to start out with Seth Tupper. He is with the Rapid City Journal. Hey, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. And then we also have Jonathan Ellis with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to start out with Seth Tupper here and a piece that he did. You can find it at rapidcityjournal.com. And we're talking about seasonal workers because 'tis the season for tourism. Seth, give me an idea of where this piece sort of originated.
Well, I was lucky enough to get a tip from one of the affected business owners out here who told me about H-2B visas and how reliant some of the tourism businesses in the Black Hills have become on getting foreign workers to obtain H-2B visas and come into the country and do seasonal work. Hmm. In South Dakota, a lot of that seasonal work is in the hospitality industry, like hotel housekeeping or restaurant cooks or food preps, or in the construction industry, like concrete construction, that kind of thing. And the problem is that last fall, some legislation expired. There was nationally the number of H-2B visas is capped at 66,000. Congress had passed an exemption for workers who had been here before so that they'd be exempt from the cap and more than 66,000 visas could be issued. Well, that expired in the fall. It was not renewed amid all of the toxic politics about immigration that we have in the country right now. And so there's a hard cap at 66,000 this year, and some employers who've been using H-2B workers for 20 or 30 years are suddenly finding that they can't get their workers that they usually get.
So, Seth, so before you go on, explain exactly what is an H-2B visa. What does it allow foreign workers to do?
That's the type of visa. It's an endorsement on somebody's passport that allows them to come into the country, and it's for temporary non-agricultural work in seasonal type industries. So these aren't people that are picking the strawberries or something like that. It's people that are, like I said, working in housekeeping jobs. They come here, like for example, to work. One of the places they featured in the story was Mount Rushmore Resort at Palmer Gulch. And they'll come here and actually live at the resort through the summer months, do housekeeping jobs, and then they'll go back to their home country. And then some of them develop relationships with their employers that are lasting, and they'll come back year after year for the same seasonal jobs and just keep going back and forth from their home country to the United States.
When does the season sort of start, and when were these workers expected to arrive by local business owners?
Well, of course, in the Black Hills, the summer tourism industry revs up in May, roughly, with the coinciding with kids getting out of school and family vacations starting. So that's when a lot of these workers would usually start, and that's part of the problem is when you have a cap nationally, employers that have earlier seasonal needs apply earlier for their employers earlier in the year, and employers who have later seasons apply later, and the people out here in the Black Hills feel like they've sort of been arbitrarily pushed to the back of the line just because their need doesn't occur until May. And so it appears that a lot of these businesses will probably go without their usual workers this year because it's getting awfully late, even if there is a legislative fix.
So then the first argument would obviously be hire local folks to do the jobs. What's the problem with that?
Exactly. And, there's legitimate arguments to be made on either side of that. What the people say who use these workers is that, look, I'm out here up in the Black Hills where there's not a lot of people. And, for example, Palmer Gulch, the resort there, they have a crew of 115 workers in the summer. It's a massive resort. And a lot of those workers, some of them do come from locally. Some of them are what's called work campers, who are retired people who take part-time jobs in the summer, RVer type people. And some of them are students, and then there's also these H-2B visa workers. And a lot of businesses like that say, look, in an area with little population and low unemployment rate, we have to cobble together a staff from wherever we can get it. And they say that even when they raise pay, they have trouble finding enough people for the jobs. And naturally, there's a lot of people skeptical about that, say, well, if they just raise the pay, they'd get the people. So it makes it a thorny issue.
All right, but worth talking about it. Let's bring Jonathan into the conversation because this is about politics affecting the South Dakota economy, South Dakota tourism, and that makes me think of this, ban or the, let's see, what do we call it? The adoption agencies, Jonathan, and how that's sort of impacting folks getting geared up to maybe not come to South Dakota because of some recent legislation. Do you want to...
Yeah, I mean, and the legislature passed and the governor signed what was somewhat of a controversial bill in which private adoption agencies, if they didn't want to adopt gay lesbian couples, they don't have to. And the governor signed that bill, and the city of San Francisco responded with a travel ban for its employees to South Dakota. I don't know how many city employees come from San Francisco to on business in South Dakota. Probably not very many, but it is symbolic and in the question of whether or not other would the state of California follow suit, that kind of thing. So, the bill is controversial. It's certainly not as controversial as what North Carolina did with the transgender bathroom bill last year, which led to NCAA pulling out of the state, but it has led to some cries for discrimination. And we've received letters from out-of-state business owners who say that they would not do business in South Dakota. So there are some consequences to it.
The political consequences on the tourism economy, especially, Seth, that hits really hard in the Black Hills area.
Yeah, and I guess it remains to be seen, if there will be an impact. You hear about this a lot, but it always, things the legislature does will impact tourism, but we still seem to draw the same 2 million people to come visit Mount Rushmore year after year, so.
Right. About the article on Mount Rushmore? Did you see that?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
New York Times.
So New York Times magazine did it. We're going to try to get the author of that on the program, by the way. Went in the middle of winter to see Mount Rushmore and wrote sort of a salty review of their experience in South Dakota. What are folks saying, Seth, about that in Rapid
City
and beyond?
Well, it's a mix of reaction. I think a lot of people are kind of chuckling at it.
Right.
He came out here in the middle of February when there was snow on the ground and, of course, was astonished by how few people we have here and how empty the streets were. And well, of course, in a tourism town in the dead of winter in February, it is going to be a little empty, so people are kind of chuckling about that.
Yeah.
That's the perspective of somebody from New York who comes out here and sees a different place. So,
On the cover of the New York Times magazine, a beautiful image of Mount Rushmore. So I don't know, maybe that will end up helping the tourism industry more than hurting it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very popular article out here. People are sharing it all over on social media and remarking on it. And so there's no doubt it drew attention to the place. And probably in the end, that's a good thing.
And also, if you want to avoid the crowds, February. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
And Jonathan Sioux Falls makes news in the Wall Street Journal as this hip, happening, cool town. So, New York takes notice to our state.
Yeah, I know. It seems like once a decade that happens.
All right, Jonathan, let's talk about speeding tickets because ArgusLeader.com, you can find a pretty extensive piece on highway patrol numbers and our 80-mile-an-hour speed limit. What do you know?
Well, I mean, just to boil it all down, the number of speeding tickets that are issued by the Highway Patrol have gone up dramatically since April 1st, 2015, which was the first day that the speed limits had gone up to 80 miles an hour on much of the interstate system there. So, the Highway Patrol obviously got a lot more aggressive in terms of giving speeding tickets. I kind of had a hunch. I remember when this sort of happened that first summer, driving some back roads on our way to Lake Madison, suddenly we were seeing Highway Patrol speed enforcement on back roads that we'd never, ever in decades seen Highway Patrol people out there before. So the question was, had they gone off of the interstate system to find people speeding on back roads? And my analysis showed that to some extent they did. There were more than doubled on back roads versus interstates. But the vast majority of tickets are given on 29 and 90. And we don't know. Unfortunately, I did get the speeding data in terms of some basic stuff of who was pulled over, where, when, what kind of car they were driving. However, the Highway Patrol refused to release the speeds at which people were traveling, and I had requested data for both a couple years before the new speed limit and after, because I wanted to compare, and they would not turn that over. So we are currently in the process of appealing that with the hearing examiners and peers. So hopefully we will be able to follow this up with a positive ruling there.
Right. And what sort of input did you get from readers reaching out to you and saying what their experiences were with the Highway Patrol?
You know, and so on social media, we mm-hmm. got some somebody very familiar on this phone call.
I may have been pulled over.
there were people. I was looking for anecdotal stuff about whether or not people. And I did actually hear from some people I know, friends who I kind of actually use for the story. People who got pulled over. They said around 83, 84, and got ticketed. And the question was, did the patrol decide to lower the cushion at which maybe they had, maybe when it was 75, the cushion was maybe 5 or 6 miles on. Did they lower that down to 3 miles? So there's some question about that.
Right, because maybe 80 miles is just fast enough, is maybe the theory
to
there.
To some people it is, yeah.
Yeah, and then other people it's a Mickey Mouse ticket to go 2 or 3, so it depends on your perspective.
Right.
So I am known traditionally as the slowest driver. I'm the person you honk at because I'm going too slowly. And yes, last year, I've been pulled over twice, once by the Rapid City Police Department for speeding. I did get a ticket, and once by the Highway Patrol. And, you go out to a place you're not familiar with, and it's hard to. I was speeding through Custer. It slows way down. It was not going above 80 in either circumstance. Seth, how about this notion of speeding and at 80 in the Highway Patrol, and the impact that is for West River?
Well, I guess one of the things I was interested in, in the piece, really, Jonathan mentioned it, but I just wanted to bring up the idea that the state wouldn't release, the speeds at which people are driving, which I can't imagine why that would be private information. So I wish the Argus luck on their appeal of that. One of the big impacts out here, another part of the piece, was talked a little about fatalities, and what's really interesting with the speed limit going up, everybody wants to know, will that have any impact on public safety? And it's really tough to gauge at this point. So much of our fatality and traffic accident stats in the state are influenced by the motorcycle rally. You might have 10, 12, 15 fatalities just attributable to the rally in any given year. And then if the numbers are down, you might have half that, and that can really impact the numbers. So it's tough to say, but I would be really interested as the years wear on, what are the updated numbers? And also with the traffic tickets, are they going to keep up that level of enforcement? Or as we all get used to it and it becomes more normal, or are they just going to, lay off, and are we going to raise it to 85, the speed limit in 5-10 years? It just seems to keep going up and up and up. We'll see where it goes.
But Jonathan, what's the process there? How long before you know what happens next?
I've waited as long as almost a year for an appeal. Now, that was when there was some transition in that office. We never win, by the way. They always rule for... And then the question is whether we want to sue them in circuit court, which we might want to this time. So we'll see.
Interesting. All right. Recapping the legislative session again, do you want to talk about anything rise to the top in that you want to make sure we cover, Seth?
When I think about the session, it's kind of counterintuitive, but I really think it was – I really think of the continued rise of sort of ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party. It may seem like they had failures this session, which they did. They passed the concealed carry, the effort to make it so you don't need a concealed carry permit to have a concealed weapon and to allow guns in the Capitol, and they lost they passed those bills and then they were vetoed, but then they lost again on the transgender bathroom issue. But, as we've seen in the coverage following that, a lot of the more conservative members of the Republican Party at the legislature feel like with Dennis Dugard's being term limited soon and probably a more conservative governor coming in, either Kristi Noem or Marty Jackley, that they're going to keep bringing these bills back, and eventually they're going to get them turned into laws, and it does feel like there's momentum in that direction, and we see gains being made out here in the legislative races. More conservative people seem to be picking up more and more seats every election, and that's my big takeaway, I think, from the session, is the continued building of momentum for the more conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Jonathan, what about East River?
I'm looking at the issues, and I think that the one issue that I'll be looking at to see what kind of impact it has is this veto that the governor had on the constitutional carry law, which basically said, you know, if you don't need a permit to carry if you can legally carry. And, you know, interestingly enough, a day or two, I think after, or maybe it was a few days after the governor vetoed, the North Dakota governor signed something very similar. So there are about a dozen states now that have laws like that, and there will be a lot of gun owners here saying, well, why can't South Dakota? And there have been, I mean, the National Association of Gun Rights, or the South Dakota Gun Owners, which are sort of anchored in Seth's area out there at West River, have been very active statewide in past elections, in particular in some East River races here, in primaries. And there have been some veteran lawmakers who've been primaried out because of ads, campaigns brought by the South Dakota gun owners. So I'll be looking to see, and they vowed in their release after the governor vetoed this, that they will be, that those who failed to override the veto will pay a political price for that. So we'll be looking to see, and that's going to be statewide. So we'll be looking for that.
Okay. Jonathan Ellis, ArgusLeader.com. You can find his work there. Thanks for being here, Jonathan.
Thanks, Lori.
And Seth Tupper, you can find him at RapidCityJournal.com. Thanks, Seth.
You're welcome.